Welcome to another great episode of Murray Musings. We've got Claire here and our friend of the pod, Mark Petchy, former coach of Andy and commentator extraordinaire. Mark and Claire, how are we all doing?
I'm doing great. Can't talk for Claire.
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, I'm tired.
She's a bit late over there, Claire. Sorry, yeah, we're all on different time zones.
We're doing a very special midnight recording here in the UK. I think it's 8 p.m. over in Miami. And Peter, what time is it where you are?
It's 5 o'clock here.
Five.
And they say nothing good happens after midnight. I mean, honestly.
Well, this is good. This is definitely good. It's really, really great to have you back, Mark. Thanks for joining us again. We're looking forward to getting your views on how Andy's year has been so far. I think you'll agree it's been quite an exceptional start to 2023 for him. But before we do any of that, I want to have a chat about what's just happened in Miami, not Miami, in Indian Wells.
Yeah.
Any standout moments from the tournament for you?
I mean, I think Carlos and obviously, Elena, Arena playing again after the AO. I think, a couple of cracking finals. The way that Daniel's played in the last sort of 5 weeks has just been extraordinary. It's fascinating to watch, isn't it? Sometimes it may not feel like a big thing, but obviously changing his string, whether that has such a big impact or whether that just kind of felt like it was something different that just allowed him to free up from some of the pressure that he had, I don't know. But obviously it's been astonishing, but Carlos, he's something else, and he is going to carry the tour. He's going to be, you listen to a great artist, you listen to Adele sing, Hometown Glory the first time you hear it, and you just go, okay, that's just unique. And he's unique, and it's going to be a fun ride for the next 15, 20 years.
Yeah, he's the real deal, isn't he? I feel like there's been quite a lot of players over the past few years that have come out and they've maybe had like one sort of standout season, or not even a full season, but just part of it. And there's been a lot of hype around them, and people are saying this is the next big player. They are going to take the place of Federer, Djokovic, Nadal. But that's never really come to much. But I feel like with Alcaraz, we are actually seeing that happen. Like, this is the guy who everyone's going to be saying, like, you're going to be talking about him, like you say, in 15 years time, like, where were you when he won his first slam?
I agree, Claire. I think that's the sense you get with him. And obviously, you know, he's timed it nicely as well. He's at the twilight of the Big Four's career as well. So obviously that's going to have a big impact in terms of what he's potentially able to achieve. Look, it's not that there's not other great players around at the moment. You know, Medvedev is going to be a lot tougher to beat on different surfaces. You know, I say different surfaces, but certainly quicker hard courts than the one in Indian Wells. But there's an attraction to the way that he plays the game as well that I think is going to hopefully endear him to a younger population. Of course, as much as we talk about obviously the popularity of this sport and everybody loves to sort of reel through the narratives of the pluses, we are still struggling to bring in a younger demographic. I feel as though Alcaraz has the potential to do that.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the way he hit through the ball with Medvedev, just trying to do any defensive shot backhand, I mean, was not working. His forehand wasn't working against Carlos. And I'm honestly shocked at the scoreline for the second set. It was just really well thought out from Carlos start to finish.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, like the plan to not attack too early in the rallies and beat himself was just perfect. You know, I mean, it's not always some massively big sort of difference that, you know, somebody's going to bring to a match, but it was the patience that he showed with the ability to hit as hard as he does and contain himself, that discipline, you know, to be able to know what you're capable of producing off your racket, but actually just to withhold it in and wait for absolutely the right ball to take it on. I mean, he talked about it afterwards in Tennis Channel's sort of interview with him, and he said the biggest thing that's changed since he met Medvedev on the grass courts a couple of years ago at Wimbledon was maturity. Obviously, he's a better player now. He understands the game better, but it is that maturity that he showed, that he was able to be patient.
Yeah.
What do you think it would take right now for a player to beat Alcaraz in the way that the form that he's in? Because I'm sort of thinking ahead, I'm getting slightly ahead of myself, but I'm thinking about there's a potential round three matchup in Miami.
Yeah.
What do you think a certain player might need to do to replicate the win that he had over Alcaraz in Indian Wells a couple of years ago?
Yeah, look, I think Andy's obviously got to get there. He's got to get past Ljubic. He's got to get past Cressy, which I think he'll like his chances against both of those two, to be honest, to give himself a crack. And listen, Andy hasn't gone through the agonies and the exercises and everything else that he's had to put his body through to not take a chance like that as well. So the motivation is high that he can get a couple of wins under the belt and get a crack at the best player on the planet as well. So, you know, not that he needs more motivation to get between the lines to compete as well as he can, then he's got all of it. What does he have to do? Well, I think he has to bring his unique brand of tennis. I think he's got one of those kind of skill sets that could upset the rhythm of Alcaraz. He could, you know, able to change up the spin. He's able to change up the pace. He's able to disrupt the rhythm of Carlos. It's, you know, if you give him the same ball all the time, he's going to enjoy that. So Andy has that, obviously, yep, up his sleeve.
But I'm really glad that you brought Andy up, Mark, you know, because I wasn't going to mention his name.
No, I'm sure you weren't.
How do you think he played in Indian Wells?
I thought he played great again. I mean, I think, listen, it's been an astonishing start to the year, hasn't it? You know, these first 10 matches have taken over 30 hours. I mean, I'm surprised he's had time to have a meal at all in 2023 so far. What with practice and then having to play matches, then it's been extraordinary. But Andy is never going to change massively, and none of the players change their DNAs hugely throughout the course of their career. Certain things dictate that you change. Conditions at Wimbledon dictated to Roger, as did one specific opponent, Hewitt, that you cannot keep serving and volleying to the degree that he did. And obviously that worked out well for him. You know, Andy at this stage of his career with the hip and everything else, there's a lot of people that would feel as though you need to be, you know, on the front foot more. You need to make shorter points, but that just isn't him. So he needed his body to catch up to a place where he could play the way that he wanted to. Obviously, it would be nicer if he could win for his body in a couple of sets, but I think the tennis that he's shown has been as good as we've seen in the last few years. I think it's been an amazing effort from him.
It's been phenomenal, hasn't it? But I think it's as well as his body's holding up for these really long matches, it's the mental capacity, I think. He almost just gets to a point where he decides there's no way I'm letting you beat me here, and there seems to be a turning point in the match, and he just comes out and he just doesn't ever give up. I feel like that's his motto right now, is just to never ever give up.
Look, he knows the clock's ticking. I mean, he knows that he's not got five more years, but he's definitely got years left potentially to give himself a chance. But I don't think he's ever felt anything other than I'm gonna win this match no matter what. And I think that was also one of the things that was incredible about how many times did we see him obviously come back from two sets of love down, but also in those tight moments with players that perhaps you were wondering why he was 4-all in the fourth set, or he was in a tight third set. He never lost those matches in general when he was at the top of the game. I mean, he just didn't really lose to those guys at any stage. And obviously coming back from the hip surgery, it's been a little tougher for him. And of course, it's going to, you know, knock a bit of your confidence in those moments. But that confidence looks to be back, that no matter what the situation is, and the reputation's there. You know, you can see players getting nervous when they have an opportunity to beat him. And again, that's something that the top players carry with them into all of these events. And Andy's got that kind of aura back at the moment.
He definitely does. I mean, his match with Echeverry was really good. It was just outstanding to see him come back after the first set into the second set, winning 6-1 and then 6-4. I mean, I was thoroughly impressed. Thoroughly impressed.
Yeah, and there's so many good players out there at the moment as well. I mean, you know, we talk about kind of the evolution of the sport. It's fast now. You know, we talk about, I mean, you can look at history and how long it's taken us to make certain inventions. I'm going a little deep and off topic here, but you know, how many millions of years it took for humans to kind of control fire, you know, and learn to how to speed up that process. In tennis, when you think about it, we're only starting the real journey in data. We're only really starting that kind of process in terms of like, you know, we've had video analysis, but I don't think it's been used massively well in tennis up till now. And I think what you're going to see is an increasing number of players that are phenomenally good because they now have information that they just never had before. So that learning process should be a whole lot quicker for the players on tour if they're getting it fed to them well by their coaches and the people that are using it.
And that is a good segue into one of the questions that I wanted to ask. On your last podcast with us, you said, "I love Hawkeye, I love data, how quickly the chess match is and what Andy's brain power is like." For Indian Wells and Cincy, I get to have a behind the scenes view as a vlogger with hearing Hawkeye stats being fed to the commentators. What is that like for you? And can you explain more about the data side of things and how you translate that to the viewers?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's one of the things that I've always been sort of very keen on ever since it sort of came into play back in 2009. I started quite early on with the SkyPad at the World Tour Finals and kind of using the Hawkeye data there. It obviously gave me, I feel as though the one thing that you can do as a commentator is obviously try and explain something that the people at home can't see. And that is, you know, that is obviously your role at the end of the day. It's not always easy to do it, but it's something that you have to do. So Hawkeye give you, as you've seen, you know, a whole list of data. It's not just about speeds of serve, it's and forehands, it's height over the net, it's cross court, down the line, backhands, forehands, pace of serve, off return. For example, I obviously keep quite a sharp eye on Emma Sill. And it was interesting to know, obviously, she had a great run in Indian Wells. But looking at the Hawkeye data afterwards, when you look at Iga's second serve speed, actually very slow in comparison to a lot of the serves that the second serves that Emma had. And Emma's second serve was considerably faster than Iga's, but she got a very quick return back from Iga because she was able to use the pace. Whereas Emma actually dropped, I think off the top of my head while I sit here, having just flown in, was down about 7 or 8 miles an hour on her second serve return speeds against Iga, even though she was getting a slower serve. So what that tells you is either Emma didn't adjust her court position as well and maybe taking the ball on the rise to be able to drive through the ball and create pace, and she was letting the air come out of it potentially and not being able to use pace as effectively. And I think that those are the things that you want to try and show to a viewer at home is the difference between her previous match and the match that she's playing against Iga. And why is that important? Because if Iga's got time on her first shot after her serve, especially on her second serve, where you're going to really try to make sort of an impression, therefore, she's going to be very hard to beat in that situation because you're not really attacking her weakness effectively. And it goes to show, and Andy's always been somebody that I've learned from in this regard, is that there's always a very strong narrative in tennis is to get up to the baseline, take the ball early, take time away, be proactive. But actually, a lot of the time as well, you have to remember that even if you take pace off, if you drop deeper, you know, a point lost or missed by the opponent is equally as good as you hitting a winner as well. And you, if you don't give pace, it's a lot harder for these players to actually create pace. So it's those nuances, Peter, that you're kind of looking for. You can pick patterns pretty quickly. I mean, that almost with the eye test on the serve, you're going to get a good feel sitting there. What you should do. Of where somebody's serving or where the success is. I quite like looking at where the return position, you know, where the returns go. More importantly, the serve has been done quite a lot, but where does somebody like to return in general? Where, if you serve wide on the deuce side to their forehand, does it always go through the middle? Does it always go cross court? You know, how often does it actually, how many players can fade it down the line like Novak? You know, so obviously if you hit a serve out wide and you know 90% of that time that ball's coming middle or to your forehand, you can leave the line. You don't have to go and worry. You can't cover 100% of a tennis court. What you're going to do is stick a ball out there because you know pretty much where that ball's going to come back to you. And that's going to be the incentive for you, is to kind of try to jump on that.
Yeah, I love to see when Andy is like ready to take the ball early on the return and he gets up to it. And yeah, it's definitely a good factoid to look at.
The data will show you, like Basilashvili, if you watch Basilashvili, he loves to serve wide on both sides. I mean, you'll find that from the Hawkeye data. You'll find those kind of patterns with certain players where they like to hit their second serves. Obviously, the other things that you can drill down to is do players like to serve faster on break points? You know, that's what you're going to be asking the Hawkeye operator. Like, what is their patterns here? Do they like to go faster on break points, or do they like to be more conservative and actually take 5 miles an hour off their first serve because they want to make their first serve? They want to make it tighter to the line. So, you know, there's an awful lot that's in there. And, you know, obviously, partly the commentator, but obviously the more the Hawkeye operators have had an opportunity, they'll know already what to look for as well.
Definitely.
I find this side of it absolutely fascinating. And it, you know, what you're saying about like you can study the, just what you said there about Basilashvili, and he goes out wide on both sides, and how a player, you can study it and you can have your game plan ready, and then maybe at the last minute you get a different opponent and it just completely wipes out your game plan. I'm thinking about what Andy had said before his match with Albot when he was supposed to have played Karen Robusta.
Yep.
He would have had a completely different game plan, and then he's got like 12 hours to kind of change how he's going to do things. And I suppose that's where, you know, that all that data from Hawkeye would come in really, really handy.
It's an incredible tool, and I think that, you know, used in the right way, that is going to give you some serious gains in terms of knowing what an opponent likes to do and where they like to play. I thought Rybakina's forehand was much better in the Indian Wells final in terms of much more down the line than it was in Australia, which was predominantly cross court. You know, and again, you can say it's predominantly cross court, and there'll be enough down the line to keep you honest. But when you say, well, I pretty much got to cover that on the big point, because if that's their favorite shot, I'm going to give them their least favorite shot. And that's what you're looking to do out of the data as well. It's not always about the fact that you're right, but it's, you know what, I'm going to give you the serve down the tee because you don't like that serve as much as the one out the wide. But if you make it, it's okay, you know, but I'm going to make you have to beat me with your least favorite shot. And that's something that the Hawkeye data will definitely give you. I will say, just as a caveat, and I've said it to Andy as well, you know, it's, you don't want to get caught up in it to the point where you feel that you know every single shot is going to be off somebody's racket. It cannot ever, it's never going to be like that. Tennis is organic, and it's certainly very much a sport that once you get past the fourth shot of the rally, anything goes. You can yep, determine fair. Some patterns between naught and four, but after that, things are going to happen that are just completely on the spur of the moment and instantaneous. And nothing beats being better than your opponent in all departments, because you don't have to worry as strategically as much about them. I think, obviously, from Andy's point of view, when he first came back from the hip surgery, I think the data was almost all consuming because his body wasn't allowing him to play the way that he wanted to play. So he was looking for an edge out of the data that almost became like the holy grail, rather than, do you know what, you're going to have to wait till your body actually gives you the opportunity to play the way that you need to play, because you're better than the opponents in all those departments. You don't need to worry as much about that again. And I think, you know, when players are confident, they'll say, I'm not really thinking. And you'll think, yeah, of course you are. But they, to a large degree, they're not.
I feel like you should do this for a living, Mark, honestly.
Some people don't.
Can I just touch quickly on the women's final yesterday in Indian Wells? I didn't watch the first set up until before the tiebreak started. Checking it on live scores, and I saw that Sabalenka was up a break and I thought she was probably going to take the first set and it would turn into a three-set match, but I wasn't sure what way it would go. And then I saw that Rybakina had broke back, so I watched the tie break, and I'm not sure I've ever seen a tie break quite like that, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it, where I've actually lost count of how many times each player double faulted when they had set point. Do you think there's a reason for that? Do you think it was just the conditions, bad luck, or is there a kind of mental block there with both players that you think was maybe just holding them back slightly in that tie break?
Yeah, I think Indian Wells is unique. Like, I think the conditions there are difficult at times for the players, and I think if you lose a bit of confidence in your mind, I think those kind of tiebreakers and those kind of messy situations do unfold. And I think that in a big final with two players that both know that the return's coming back at Mach 5, you know, there's not going to be any holding back in terms of what's coming back. That puts an awful lot of pressure on your second serve. So, you know, you can always look at it as the person that's delivering the serve, you know, has a mental weakness. But there's also what is happening down the other end of the court is going to make you try and hit maybe a better serve than you would like to hit. You know, I mean, with all due respect, Sabalenka's serving against me. She's not going to feel as though she has to hit such a great second serve because I'm not going to crunch the return in the same way as Rybakina was going to do yesterday. So I think I'll always be sort of, you know, I will still always have empathy in those moments. It's easy to look at it and think, well, you're world class. You know, you've got an Australian Open and a Wimbledon champion playing out there. You should be better than that. But they're both trying to counter something that they both know they do well, which is massive return of serves, getting them on the run. They're not, I think Elena actually moves better than Sabalenka. And I think she moves a little bit better, to be honest, Peter. Sorry. Okay. Carry on.
Oh, well, I wasn't expecting that. The way I saw it, definitely was Sabalenka's return, like at the end of the tiebreak. I actually just drove in from Indian Wells into Las Vegas for that tiebreaker. So probably Claire and I saw about the same bits for the tiebreaker. And it was just... It was something.
Yeah, look, I mean, they're both players that at times are hitting the ball harder off the ground than the men are. You know, so you're going to get with a flatter hit, you're going to get errors. I mean, you're going to get errors. There's no room to really build a point in that regard. I mean, it is basically tennis played in the 0-4 range of shots. And that's both of their ways of feeling like they're going to be the most competitive and they have the best chance of winning. And they're just not going to back down from that particular sort of mindset. And I think that, you know, it's kind of colorful and it's certainly grabbing our attention in terms of a rivalries at the moment. Is this the genesis of a big three, at least, on the women's tour at the moment, with Iga as well, because they look as though they're starting to put together some nice, consistent results, and that will be they'll be fun to see. But yeah, look, I may be in the minority here. I'd love to see people create a rivalry. If I'm being completely honest and candid, I don't know if it's going to be my favorite rivalry.
Oh, really? Is that because do you think maybe are their styles too similar to one another to create a really exciting game?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not being I'm saying it with all the kindness and empathy and I can't emphasize enough what great tennis players they are, and I think they're both wonderful people as well. I mean, they both speak well and everything else. So, you know, just that if you took boxes, tick 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 tick, absolutely. I'm not sure when they both get on the opposite side of the net to them that the matches are going to be, you know. And again, I have to say that I'm so invested in the sport and I'm so sort of myopic that I'm not always the best person to talk to about it, because, you know, there'll be a lot of people that, because the Aussie final went long, would say, well, that was amazing. And it's like, well, it was because it got amazing because it was tight and there was so much on the line and, you know, everything else. So I can appreciate all of that. But if you're going to ask me in isolation what I think of the actual rallies and the way the matches, it's for me, it's a bit short and punchy and a few too many unforced errors in those moments that maybe for me personally doesn't make that matchup something that I'm necessarily going to be saying, right, I want to wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning to watch it. But yeah, listen, we're here. That's not a fact. It's just an opinion. And we're here to have opinions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I tend to agree. I do think they've got very similar games. It'll be interesting to see how things go on a different court, for example, on a different surface, if they were to meet each other, maybe on clay, for example. I'd be interested to see how that goes. But that's a totally other season. I don't even want to think about clay right now. Yeah. I need to get Miami out of the way first, which is where you are right now. What are you most looking forward to about Miami?
I think it's always challenging. Coming off a massive tournament the week before for a lot of these players, and then having to kind of, you know, knuckle down and make the change, different ball, you know, different conditions. So therefore, you know, definitely a lot more humidity here. The ball's going to hang in the air a little bit more. So, you know, those changes that certainly the players that have been at the business end of Indian Wells have got to make is always going to be interesting to see. And then obviously you've got a whole bunch of players here coming in with a massive amount of optimism. And if they've lost early in Indian Wells, maybe, you know, they're super desperate to obviously make something happen. And I think that this is, you know, the last hardcore tournament for almost 4 months. So, you know, there are some of those players out there that will be thinking like, oh, I need to make something happen here. So, you know, there's a little air of desperation in Miami sometimes for these players, you know, that haven't done as well in Indian Wells and maybe the weeks prior to this, that this is their last chance. If they are sort of Daniil Medvedev hardcore specialists, they're going to want to grab it here.
Speaking of Daniil Medvedev as a hardcore specialist, I'd like to talk about Indian Wells court real quick. So Blair Henley asked Petra Kvitova if she agrees with Medvedev that Indian Wells courts play like clay courts. And she said, I do, unfortunately. Can you talk about Indian Wells courts and definitely about Andy's historically level on those courts?
Yeah, I think the conditions of her, I think Andy hasn't loved the conditions more than the ball. I think, you know, in the past, I think that's been kind of more of a, you know, the scenario for him in Indian Wells. It's just the lighter air and, you know, and again, also, you know, as you guys know better than I do here on Murray Musings, you know, he's also come off some pretty devastating losses in Australia as well. You know, so I've always thought that when I've looked at his Indian Wells record, I'm like, you know what, that's not a loss that he's going to get over in a couple of weeks, you know. So he's already heading into Indian Wells and he's still got the residue of, you know, another Aussie Open final lost, you know, in some brutal circumstances, as you guys know as well. So that's always had, I'm sure, an effect on him going into Indian Wells. And then he's kind of bounced back nicely in Miami, where obviously he lived and he trained and everything else. So much more comfortable. I think the tour's got to start making some very big decisions about its product. And I think they've got to start managing situations for the future of the sport a little bit better. I mean, there isn't a rule that, you know, the tournaments have to change balls. So the ball can be the same for Indian Wells and Miami. I think that obviously we know that these tournaments, their own individual entities, they can kind of do what they want. But for the good of the sport, it made no sense that you went from Dallas to Delray to Acapulco to Indian Wells to Miami, and they've had a different ball every single week. Yep. You know, I mean, that just isn't great. For me personally, people talk about injuries. I'm not even worried about that. I'm worried about entertainment value. Every single sort of first couple of rounds, how do those players adjust? How does that help the sport that you've got a completely different ball? You go out and give a golfer a different ball every single week and they've got to control it, you know, and they're not going to be able to do it. So it hurts the sport from an entertainment point of view. And I think, you know, we've got obsessed with giving fans at least 90 minutes of tennis, or 2 hours plus, as you guys, again, you know better than I do when you watch some of these matches. You know, I watched, what was it, Badosa and Haddad Meyer in Adelaide. We played two sets in 2 hours and 40 minutes. I mean, it's like, it's crazy, you know, to me, that we are obsessed with this length of time. I think we need to be very careful that we're not putting a ball in play that encourages a huge degree of skill sets for all players. There are players that can do it, like Carlos, but I do think that we're running the risk of just putting out a steady diet of the same things. And I'm not sure that's the best way forward for tennis.
Yeah. And I heard the balls were not great in Indian Wells, pen, right?
Yeah, they were soft. And I think, you know, once they go dead, you've got to swing hard and you can't get the ball through the court. I mean, you know, I've always been a big advocate that, you know, people want to see winners, which is why I've always been a little bit sort of pro shrinking the width of the net. You know, boringly back in the 19th century, the net posts actually started out on the singles lines. And I'm a big believer that, you know, we should have a singles net on the main stadium courts rather than the doubles net, which is nuts because you can't go around it. For someone like Daniil, he actually gets penalized by having a doubles net on a singles match because he returns from so far back. He actually can't go around the net off a return because he's got a doubles net in front of him rather than a single. So he's actually handicapped, you know, for the style of play that he has because of the equipment that's stuck out on the court. That is the wrong equipment, you know. So you could have one of these newsworthy returns from Daniil, but the sport takes it away because you've got to have a sponsor sign on the net. So there's stuff that I have actually spoken to the tour about it, and I've been quite vocal on changing the color of the ball on the clay. I think most of us watch on iPads. Most of us watch on phones these days at times because we've got busy lives. You can't see the ball. It's just not the color differential is just not big enough. You know, and I think that whole leads into, we've got ourselves in a situation because there is no product committee on the tours or even at the slams that are discussing these issues that could help the sport. And I think it's more relevant than a lot of other things that we need to tackle.
Yep.
What, out of curiosity, what colour ball do you think they should use on clay?
Well, I said that the blue clay back in 2012 looks amazing. If you go and look at it, take away the fact that the players struggled to move on it, and it had obviously an issue that just prior to the tournament getting underway that week, that the players obviously just said, no, we're not doing this again. So I accept that. I accept the fact that, you know, the blue clay didn't work, and you can't throw that around Europe and have a risk that the players can't move because it's not good for the sport. But the one thing that I thought was really obvious coming out of it was, well, optically it looks great. So if we can't do the blue clay, but why do we not try and change the color of the ball? Because then optically that surely has to be, you know, something we could do. So I said to the tour, just go to the ball manufacturers, get six different spectrum of ball colors. And obviously you have to take things in consideration, like the back netting and green. And if it's got black writing on it, it can't really be a black ball. But I said, look, you've got enough people in Monte Carlo, go and throw out six different colored darker balls and see which one the players say they can pick up in the backstop and everything else. And I don't know, to be honest, Claire, like the perfect color. I think that a light blue like the clay wouldn't be a bad, I think that would be a ball that you could pick up pretty quickly optically. And I think it would just be pretty helpful for the sport. But, you know, again, it's never even been discussed. You know, and I think that, you know, when you watch golf, you know, they have different tournaments, you know, like they have tournaments where, you know, the world number one gets an extra stroke for a bit of fun. They have, you know, they have match play. They have, you know, the Phoenix tournament. And I think that we've got an opportunity in the sport right now to kind of try things and make sure that we're giving the best the best, absolutely the best product. And I'm not convinced that the conversations are happening. And again, we go back to Indian Wells being a big highlighter for me, is saying that the ball isn't good enough, or, you know, that should be something that we're ahead of the curve there, not behind it in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just interested to hear your thoughts there, because as soon as you said about clay, because I always struggle to see the yellow ball on clay, always. Yep. My first thought was a blue ball would work on the orange clay quite well.
Like a highlighter blue would be good.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I think so. And, you know, it wouldn't take much to make it happen. You know, the technology is so quick these days. You go film it, you stick it on your iPad, you go, wow. I mean, you know, like you talk to people and, you know, you've got to learn from history. You know, I don't know if you guys do know, but maybe you don't. You know, so I apologize if I'm telling you something you already know. But, you know, obviously, David Attenborough was the BBC Two controller. So now Sir David Attenborough, but he was the BBC Two controller. And the reason that the Wimbledon ball changed from being white to yellow was because he couldn't see it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
that's fascinating.
So that's the whole reason. So we have precedent in the sport that the reason that it got changed, because he said, I can't see it. And, you know, it's not rocket science. A white ball on a white line,
you
completely lose it. So, you know, we changed the ball then to a yellow one because of that reason. And for so long, I feel in tennis, I know that I'm at times like a, you know, disruptor, whether that's been with the LTA, whether it's been with, but it's like, I love this sport, and I think that you can't sit on your laurels, especially with the competition that we have with so many other industries, and not just in sport now, obviously with esports and everything else that the kids have the potential to do, that what we can do is make this product, you know, absolutely the best that we can, and simple little things that are not changing scoreboards or anything else like that. Like optically, I can sit on the train on the London Underground and I can watch a clay court tennis match and actually see what's going on a little bit better than I currently can, which I can't see at all. Just see two people moving, like, you know, what was that game that we used to play that first came out on Amstrad? It was a little like ping pong. And it's like, well, you know, that just doesn't make sense for me as a big fan of this sport, that I can't see the ball.
Yeah, well, I think we've actually found the solution here in the David Attenborough effect, and we should maybe just petition him to ask if he's managed to do it once, he can do it again. Let's just get him to say that when he enjoys.
Not just because of the ball. Yeah
just enjoy. I mean, who can say no to Sir David Attenborough? I bet you, Mark, I bet you if he asked the question, they would do it for him, because they'd do anything for him.
Yeah, 100%.
Can I get your thoughts on, I was having a look at the draw for Miami, and again, looking back at the draw for Indian Wells, and it's only when I sit down and I actually look at the draw properly that I see that there's 32 buys for each of these tournaments, and I find that incredible, and I think it's too many, and they must be the only tournaments that do it. And I wanted to see what you think about that, about giving all, like, there's some players they are seeded that I'm like, I don't think in normal circumstances you would get past round one. No disrespect. I mean, you'd get past round one if you were playing me, for sure. But it's mad that they're getting this buy into round two. And I just wanted to see what you thought about this 32-player buy.
Yeah, it's a great question, Claire. I actually tweeted it the other day. I'm completely invested and completely on side with the economics of the decision to go to bigger tournaments, for the tournaments themselves and also for the players. I'm not massively on side from, again, I go back to the product and I go back to the fans. We're going to be offering up another same product as the tournaments get longer in Madrid and Rome. And I think that when you look at what we're trying to do here as a sport, you want to hit it hard with a highlight. And by giving 32 buys, apart from the jobs, you know, at least 16 you feel like shouldn't be getting buys, and 16 other players could be getting main draw matches rather than having to play in qualifying. You don't have any big stars playing on the first few days.
Well, you've got Andy.
You've got Andy because you've got Emma, you know, because and Bianca because they've dropped down the rankings. But they're the outliers. But they're not the reasons that you should keep something because it's happened. It's for me. It's like how do you tell people at home in the UK, you know, if that wasn't the case that Emma was playing and Andy was playing, what is Miami on? Because you wouldn't even know it was on until like Saturday, and then Saturday it's on against the football and 50 other things that are going on, and then before you know it, it's Monday and you've lost like the first 5 days, the 6 days of the tournament to it's kind of behind a curtain. So sorry, but for me personally, yeah, I'm not a big fan. I would either go 16 back, so you only have 16 buys, and I get the fact that some of the players that are coming from Indian Wells need buys, but the other argument to say is that you actually make it a smaller draw and you have a bigger gap between the two, and you start with Alcaraz coming out onto court and saying, right, Miami's underway. We've got, you know, the world number one or the Indian Wells champion. It doesn't always work that they're both. And that's how the tournament starts, because it's a big curtain raiser. You know, you don't do a Hollywood blockbuster and kind of, you know, just, you know, you don't just, A, you don't put it on at the weekend up against 50 different other big entertainment things and sport things. You do it Monday or whatever when there's nothing else on. And I think we need to have a think about that, because I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah. I think I'm trying to remember when both of these tournaments became the size that they are, and I know they've been
a long time back
for a long time now.
I played even when I was playing in the black and white television days. It was 96, so I know that for sure.
So it's been a really long time.
A really long time. Yeah, the Jurassic period.
How long has Indian Wells been considered the fifth slam? Do you know?
Well, it was always Winter Wimbledon. That was its initial name when it started, obviously, over in Crandon. So, okay. I mean, so obviously when it moved to Crandon, I mean, it basically, you know, it became kind of known as Winter Wimbledon.
I was talking about Indian Wells.
Indian Wells. I don't know why Indian Wells became the fifth
slam. Is Miami considered the fifth slam to you? Because I know Ron DeSantis said that to try to get Novak to play.
I mean, that's a whole different other issue.
Yes, exactly. I did not want to mention that, but yeah, you mentioned Crandon.
I'm just not a big fan of the fifth slam. I mean, I don't want to be a killjoy here, but I mean, it's like four's enough. I don't need a fifth slam. I don't need a fifth slam. I don't need it. It's like we've got the history of the other four. I love them to bits. I love Indian Wells as it is. You know, that's tennis paradise. You can't see a tweet, you can't see an Instagram post without hashtag tennis paradise. And this this was always Winter Wimbledon, you know, and that's how I'll remember it, you know, and I think it's that they should always be seen as awesome tournaments in their own kind of individual ways. Again, by comparing them, we take away what their kind of uniqueness is. You can't compare Miami to Monte Carlo, for example, apart from the surface difference. It's one of the great things about tennis is that we take it to such great global cities, and we should cherish that and build that as our kind of narrative, rather than always kind of trying to say this is the fifth slam or this is that, because actually it detracts a little bit, because you're trying to be something you're never going to be. So you're always going to fail. You're mm-hmm. destined to fail. So that doesn't make any sense to me from a PR perspective, that you're saying something that is doomed.
Yeah. Switching gears for just a little bit. I would like to talk about Anastasia Potapova's wearing a t-shirt with the Russian soccer team, Spartak Moscow. Can you talk a little bit about that? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I think it was disappointing. I think we're in a very difficult situation here. And I think that people are entirely deluded. And hypocritical if they're going to say that sport and politics are going to, you know, can't be combined, or they shouldn't be combined, and we could keep them separate. We would love to keep them separate. In a perfect world, I'd love to keep it separate as well. But the reality is that there is a massive war, an unjustified war going on in the Ukraine. And I think that the general sort of feeling amongst the players on the tour, I feel has been right. You know, I think that, I'm not going to name names, but the people that have obviously stepped up, and we kind of know who they are, that certainly feel as though they're against it, have subtly made their feelings made. And I just think that was wholly unnecessary. And it was, you know, I think that she needs to have a good think about what's happening in those Ukrainian players' lives, families, friends, to make a really ill-judged decision. And I hope we don't see the like of it again.
Yep. Yeah. It's definitely hard to hear about Lisa Cerenko's issue with her panic attacks going into the match, that she hopefully wanted to play against Aryna Sabalenka, but then withdrew. I don't know if you heard more.
There's been 8 matches that she's retired or been injured.
Yeah, I was just about to say she's withdrawn from quite a few. So, and those 8 matches were just, some of them just random seeming.
I mean, look, you know, none of us can put ourselves in their shoes, you know, like the Ukrainian shoes. I mean, I'm not going to judge anyone's decision to not play or behave irrationally on the court. I mean, there's enough tennis players that behave irrationally without that going on. But obviously, you know, with it going on and the fact that they can't go home and the fact that they've, you know, well over a year now that they haven't been able to, you know, and have had to worry every single day that I'm sure that they've woken up, that, you know, people that they love and care about are still going to be alive. You know, I mean, I can't even begin to put myself in the shoes that they have, and, you know, just huge sympathy and for them, and obviously for the, like everybody else, just hope that somebody can bang somebody's heads together and get some common sense, and the world can get back to trying to be at one with each other. You know, I mean, it never comes to any good, this stuff.
Yeah, totally agree. But I actually saw a little clip of something recently. I think it might have been a John Bishop podcast.
Yeah.
And he had Cyrian McKellen on. And he was talking about how he came into Manchester, into the train station. He jumped in a taxi and the taxi driver said to him, Where are you going, love? And he said, that feeling of just, he says, in Manchester, everyone just calls everyone love. He says, and I felt like if everyone could just take that approach to everyone that they meet in life, we'd be in a much better place. And it was the way that he delivered it much better than me. But I just couldn't agree more, like just that sort of just take everyone as they come kind of thing. And you'd have a lot more harmony in it. And I just thought, well, yeah, that's kind of what we need right now, isn't it? I agree with you completely, Mark. I can't even begin for a second to imagine how the Ukrainian players are feeling. So with the same, I hope that things get better really soon. Before we wrap things up and just to kind of move on to a slightly lighter note, every person that we've had on the podcast this year and every person that I speak to that will listen to me and allow me to talk about Andy in general, I've asked them this question. What did you think of the Kokkinakis match in Australia?
I mean, I was commentating on it, so
I was there, so I didn't get to hear the commentary.
No, I know you were there. I saw pictures of you there. So I mean it's so hard to put into words at times what Andy has meant to us all, and the entertainment factor that he has. I mean, we get wrapped up, and I said this a little bit about Carlos at the moment as well. You know, every kind of nugget of treasure that he gathers, we're comparing him to Rafa, or we're comparing him to Bjorn Borg, or we're comparing him to, it's like, that's, as the saying goes, is is the thief of joy. You know, it's just like, what, just love him. Just welcome into the stadium, get there on the tennis court, and sit back and enjoy tennis utopia. And Andy is the same for me. You just never know. He's like an author, but he's not like an author that's got a set pattern of the way that he's going to write the novel. And every time you buy one of their books, you know roughly what's going to happen, but you know there's going to be a sting in the tail.
There's going to be absolute chaos in the middle.
Yeah. It could start one way, end another, begin as the last one ended, and then finish as the other one. Or it could be completely on its head, and you have no idea which one's coming. All you know is that at some point in a match like that, something's going to happen. Something is going to happen that it doesn't always obviously work out that he wins it, but something happens that changes the whole course of it. And I said it again there, he's been the greatest killer of dead air that I have ever known. In between points, because that's also one of my bugbears, is that the sport gives the same amount of recovery time for an ace that it does for a 45 shot rally, which is absolutely mental. You know, so why would we do that? It's like, it doesn't make any sense at all. But Andy, in between points and in between everything, I watch matches at times, and I'll be honest, I can watch for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and that felt like a bit of a, like I had to like wade through that. I watch Andy 4 hours and I'm like, oh, that felt like it went by in an instant. I could do another four of those. And that's why I say it's difficult to describe in words what it means, because you kind of have to live it and you have to visualize it rather than describe it, because it has a life of its own, his tennis matches, that will be indelible, you know. And that was another one of those indelible memories that you'll always remember and think, wow, how the hell did he do that?
How the hell did he do that, Mark?
He got a bit of help from Thanasi. I hate to remind Thanasi, he got a bit of help, but at the same time, there was some, and obviously the one point with the defense that sums him up in it. Like, and again, I would never want to do. Yeah, there'll come a point where obviously he does hang the rackets up, and I'll think about, you know, writing something that does mean what he has meant to me throughout the course of his 20 plus years that I've seen him play tennis. But for me personally, I would rather almost do it visually. I'd almost rather create something because it's meaningful, because he's created sort of, you know, optical illusions on the tennis court.
Well, I will watch that when you do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lastly, I would like to talk about Taylor Swift, as we talked about the last time, you're a Swift fan. For Taylor's Era Tour, she's singing 44 songs.
Can you 3 hours?
Five?
44 songs for 3 hours, huh?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yes. Yeah. Almost as much as an Andy Murray match. Can you narrow down like five songs that you'd like to listen to? Two sets. So can you narrow down about five songs that you'd like to listen to if you were at her concert?
Five songs that I would like to listen to. That's pretty good. I was just listening to hers on the way over, actually. You've got me thinking. It's not a lot for Taylor. What am I going to go with? I love 22.
Yes.
Feeling 22. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love it. I love The Last Great American Dynasty.
I was about to put that in my top five.
Have you got that in your top five?
No. That almost made the cut. Top 10.
All Too Well is an absolute no-brainer.
Personally,
I like the 10 minute version.
Of course.
So the new one. What else am I going to go with here? Love Story.
I was going to say, I quite like a wee throwback to the old classics.
Yeah.
But you belong with me.
I'm sad that she's doing, like, I quite like Champagne Problems as well.
I love Champagne Problems.
Yeah, I like Champagne Problems. It's a great line as well, because I also think about it a lot in my life at times when it's like, I think I've got a problem, and I go, nah, it's a champagne problem.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a Taylor Swift song you can relate to anything that's going on in your life at any time, yeah. To be honest. There's such a massive catalogue to pick from. You can be like, what Taylor Swift can have playing in the background of today's fresh hell? There's definitely something.
she's been through the whole gamut of absolutely everything. Yeah, no, 100% that she's there. So I actually just hardly ever listen to anything else. I like ran, and I keep thinking to myself, I need to branch back out again here. I've gone down into the Taylor Swift, you know, rabbit hole, and there is actually no way out. Like, they put the lid on and then you just stay there for the rest of your life, and you're never going to get out again. It's like, it would be a terrible business model really for Apple if they really just, you know, had to pay for Taylor's songs, and you know, that would be it. You could just be £14 gone. But like I said, you know, there's people that come into life in their various fields that they excel at, and you know, just as Andy has done in tennis, and Taylor's obviously done it in her music.
I feel like you could do, you know, you're talking about like your kind of video compilation,
yeah.
Mark.
Yeah.
You have to have a selection, yeah, of Taylor Swift songs to go into, yeah, the background. Yeah. I think there could be a Swift song for pretty much every match you pick.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. We'll start it off with Tolerator. There we go. You may not like it, but you're tolerating it.
ending with Anti-Hero.
Yes, sure. Exactly. Yeah, that was it. Yeah. What did I see? Somebody came up with a good line the other day. They said it eagers the anti-Murray, the way that she was carving through people. So it was, yeah. Yeah, that Sir Anti Murray. That's it. Sir Anti Murray. Eager was Sir Anti Murray.
I like it. Yeah, it was good. I like it.
It was good. Until she got cuffed, and then it was useless.
Well, that is, I think that's a good top five. Peter, do you agree?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And you guys? Yeah, which one's Peter?
I love Mirrorball, Illicit Affairs, This Is Me Trying, yeah, and Exile. Those, yeah, would be my top five.
Yeah.
That's only four.
Mirrorball. Oh, four. Sorry. The Last Great American Dynasty. Yeah. That actually was my fifth one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I didn't add that. I wasn't typing fast enough.
Yeah, small world as well. So the bus guy that used to help us in that just outside the Conrad at the US Open last year, he used to live in that area, which that house that Taylor bought, that was in that song. And he used, uh-huh, to go to that particular house in his summer holidays.
Nice. Small world. Yeah. It seems like a nice place. I'd love to.
Sounded
visit.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
When's our invite coming? When's Taylor inviting us?
I feel like
that's
it needs
a very
to be
good
soon.
Question.
Like, we talk about it a lot. This could actually turn into like some sort of hybrid Andy Murray Taylor Swift podcast, the way that we're going.
get Andy on the vocals with Taylor.
Andy doing his rapping with Taylor playing in the background.
Yeah, just a little bit more enthusiasm in the voice, Andy.
Tell you what, you can raise that with them this week in Miami and like, okay, see how we get with it, okay? Be back, let us know how you get on.
I will. After he beats Alcaraz in the third round, I'll ask him, because he'll be in a good
mood. Yeah, that'll be a good time to do it, because he'll be absolutely buzzing, and I bet he'll agree to anything, Mark. So, yeah, once he's beaten Alcaraz, ask him if he'll come on Murray Musings, have a chat about Taylor Swift, and maybe record some music while we're at it.
What have I got here? There we go. We can end on that. I was bringing this over for a mate of mine. This is one of his first ever rackets.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's even got the frayed strings. Can you see that?
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
That is, yeah, really cool.
That's even got the gut still in it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can see some blood on there as well, I think.
Yeah, blood, sweat and tears, mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
After it hit me over the head with it.
So, just a little afraid.
Just a little. Yeah.
I think that's what that's got to be one of my goals, is to get one of his rackets at some point in my life before he retires. Yeah. I'll see if he can smash one up at Wimbledon and try and get it off him.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, this is, I think it hasn't changed much, to be honest. It's still the same technology. I think it's a little bit, still a bit heavy. It's not as heavy in the head these days as it was back then. So, but it's still got the old, he's got the old caracal grip on here, but that's faded a bit since then.
I noticed it's a head racket. That was, I don't know if you saw his pun on Twitter the other day.
When he thought he was very clever there, didn't he?
I must admit, I laughed out loud when
I
giggled.
He's a smart one. He's a smart one.
He really is. He really is. And on that note, I think we'll wrap things up. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. Just love having you on and hearing your chat. Have an amazing time in Miami. We're looking forward to following your updates on Twitter. Definitely have a chat with Andy. Once he beats Alcaraz.
We'll get that duet going.
Yeah. Yes, I think it has to happen. It has to happen. We'll call it an Andy Swift. Thank you.
The Swift Scott.
Love it.
I'm totally here for it. Right, everyone, thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I know I've certainly enjoyed recording it. Peter, it's been great to see you again as well. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Have a great time in Miami, and we'll hopefully see you again soon.
Will do. Take care.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Take care, y'all.
Bye.
Bye.